The Tom Woods Show, episode 513.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Friends, if you're planning to buy gold, make sure you don't get ripped off. There are a lot of scams out there. So read Peter Schiff's report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off. You can read it for free through tomwoods.com/scams. Welcome to episode 513. Today, we're going back to that Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist article. Jeff Herbener and I are, and we're going to look at some other sections and some other points of contention and see what we can do to resolve them. In particular, we're going to talk about the economic calculation problem, and we're going to talk about under socialism, and then we're going to talk about monopoly theory among Austrians, and we're going to explain what those are, and then we're going to show what the criticisms are and see if the criticisms stick or not. So we're going to do that. I'd like to try to get to public goods also, but I'm not quite sure we'll be able to do that in this particular episode. Jeff Herbener is the chairman of the Department of Economics at Grove City College, one of the best four-year liberal arts schools that you've never heard of. It always ranks really highly, but it is not well known. It should be much better known, especially among libertarians, because it accepts absolutely no form of government money whatsoever. And the entire economics department is Austrian or Austrian sympathetic. And you would study under Jeff Herbener and my friend Sean Rittenour. What an experience that would be. If you want to have a tremendous undergraduate experience, that would be it, I would say, especially for economics. I will be linking to the Kaplan article at tomwoods.com/513, and I'll also link to previous episodes in which we addressed some of the claims in this article. So at tomwoods.com/513, you'll get the whole package, at least up to this point where we are in the article. Jeff Herbener, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
We certainly have to finish this article, and then I'll have other topics for you, but I think this just has to get done. So as I told people just a minute ago, we're looking at the famous Why I Am Not an Austrian Economist article by Brian Kaplan, and we're just going through it in as detailed a way as we can. And we've jumped back and forth and gone a little bit out of order to just, as I've found, topics that are manageable for particular amounts of time on the show. So we're going to look at applied topics. We're going to look at the first three of part three. So if you'd like to follow along with us, the article will be on the show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/513. And we're going to begin with 3.1, which is economic calculation and the impossibility of socialism. And Kaplan has impossibility in quotation marks. He says that Mises considered the socialist calculation argument to be a decisive objection to the economic feasibility of socialism. And he then gives us the gist of the Misesian argument and then goes on to say, but socialism has so many problems with it that there's no particular reason to think this would be the fatal one, or that economic calculation, the absence of economic calculation, would have consequences so severe that it would have to lead to the complete collapse of the whole system. Surely we can say that the Soviet Union collapsed for a variety of reasons and not exclusively or even primarily because of the lack of economic calculation. I think I'm fairly stating his thesis here, but in order to evaluate it, we need to understand what is the socialist calculation problem. I've covered this in one or two episodes, but given that I've done 513 of them, I don't think it could hurt to revisit the subject. So, Jeff, if you want to just give us a basic, bare bones overview of the socialist calculation problem, then we can get into the Kaplan objection.
Sure. Here, Mises is innovating, really, a brand new argument, or bringing to fruition a brand new line of argument against socialism. So he says socialism is the system of economy where we have central planning or state decision over all productions in a division of labor economy. And previous to Mises, the basic argument against removing private property and putting it all property ownership in the hands of the state was it would create an incentive problem. And Mises recognizes the incentive problem, but he says there's a more fundamental problem with the attempt to centralize the ownership of all the means of production in the hands of the state and eliminate private property. And he says this is the problem of decision-making with respect to the use of these resources in a way that satisfies the preferences of the decision-makers. So as he points out, if you eliminate all private ownership of property and the state owns all property, then there can be no trade in the means of production, no trade in labor, no trade in land, no trade in factories, equipment, and so on. So there could be no prices for any of these producer goods. And if there are no prices for producer goods, then it's impossible, he argues, for the central planners to calculate which combination of producer goods and producing any consumer good will keep their opportunity cost at a minimum. And therefore, any decision they make will be inefficient or at least willy-nilly. And as he points out, you can't do this calculation of opportunity cost in kind because the different factors of production are denominated in different units. So you can't add acres of land to hours of labor to numbers of machines. You know, if one production process takes two machines, 1 acre of land and 20 hours of labor, and another one takes five machines and half an acre of land and 30 hours of labor, you can't tell which production process in the raw amount of physical producer goods minimizes the value of the inputs. So he says the way that this problem is solved in the market is, of course, to have money prices determined by people's free choice to buy and sell things, including the entrepreneurs, their free choice to set up an enterprise and buy and sell inputs and produce output. Because now it's possible to know the monetary cost of all the different factors of production, and the monetary costs being denominated in a common unit of money can be added up, and the minimum cost production technique can then be determined.
All right, so that's what Mises is talking about. And when we see the Kaplan treatment of the question, he says, he says that, for one thing, the problem with Mises' argument is that there's no reason that we should expect or that he can know by economic theory alone that the effects of the lack of economic calculation would be severe enough to make socialism entirely infeasible. Because he says that, after all, Mises says over and over again that economic theory can't give you quantitative laws, only qualitative ones. This is greater than that, this is less than that, whatever. So how can he make that kind of determination? Why can't he just say that the lack of economic calculation will make socialism quite difficult, but it won't necessarily mean the system can't possibly work?
Mm-hmm. Here I think Kaplan is confusing two different realms of economic analysis. He seems to be saying, on the one hand, if we look at historical cases, at the empirical evidence, it's hard to disentangle the causal factors that lead to the lower productivity of any particular historical economy. But what Mises is talking about is, in fact, a qualitative difference, or we might say a categorical difference. He's talking about the difference between a market economy of any degree of intervention. So we could have basic market economies that have some private property and money and contracting and trade and so on. We can see different variations of state ownership or interference in private property in different economies. So he's talking about that on the one hand, and then how he defines socialism, how Mises defines socialism on the other, which is the complete state ownership of all means of production. So in order to see in a historical case Mises's argument play out, so the economic calculation causal factor play out in history on its own, you'd have to find an example of a division of labor economy where the state takes over the means of production and then eliminates money. That's a fairly rare occurrence in history. About the only example I can think of is war communism in Russia. And in that instance, of course, we did see the whole economic system begin to collapse, just as Mises would have anticipated. And Lenin, of course, coming up with a new economic policy very quickly and reinstituting some modicum of private property and markets and the reinstitution of money and the ability then to engage somewhat in economic calculation.
He says, he goes on to say this, he says, look, he can understand how, Mises himself can understand how one person could make calculations in kind for his own, you know, his own ends. But does that mean that when Friday shows up, now we can't get by without prices? Or would that mean we'd have to wait for 10 people before it becomes not feasible to have an economy without prices? Or would it be 100 or 1,000? He says, Mises' distinction between a modern economy and Crusoe's, and why the economic calculation argument applies only to the former, again shows that Mises has underlying quantitative assumptions in spite of his strictures against them. He's making a quantitative judgment that the lack of calculation would not greatly worsen Crusoe's economy, but would devastate a modern economy. Perhaps Mises was right, but pure economic theory did not give him the answer. What are your thoughts there?
Right. Again, I think he maybe is just glossing over a bit this categorical difference that Mises is talking about. So just to clarify, what Mises is saying is that with Caruso, we don't have a division of labor economy. Caruso is self-sufficient, and he produces whatever he can consume on his own effort. And so he, in his own mind, then can conceive of the entire system of production that he engages in systematically. He can assess it systematically. And since he's the producer of every different line of production, he's the one gathering coconuts, he's the one making nets to catch fish, he's the one picking berries and so on. He can have personal experience with each of the lines of production so that he can assess subjectively in his own mind the opportunity cost of doing one thing relative to another. That's the Caruso economy. And then the what Mises is contrasting that to is a division of labor economy. So what if we have a division of labor? What if Friday comes and they divide their labor, and instead of doing what they would do in a market economy, which is each one of them has private property over his own production process, and they engage in let's say Caruso gathering coconuts and Friday is picking the berries, so that they're specialized, neither one of them is doing what the other person is doing, then we would have the beginning of the market economy. But what socialism would be in that context is that Caruso is going to decide all the production processes in the economy because he owns all the means of production. He owns Friday's labor. And so we can see right away that it wouldn't be possible for Caruso to economize with respect to Friday's labor in the production process and processes in which Caruso himself is not involved. He can't personally assess the opportunity cost in his own mind of picking berries if he himself is not picking the berries, but instead is simply assigning Friday to pick the berries. And while also, of course, he can't use in-kind calculation once the production processes move beyond his own mind where he's doing everything. He can't use the amounts of the different factors of production, as we explained before, to determine whether Caruso himself should be doing one thing and Friday doing another, or whether Friday should be picking the berries in one way or a different way, or whether nets should be made for fish catching, and whether Caruso should catch the fish or Friday catch the fish, and so on.
He says at the end of this section, "There is no natural experiment of a socialist economy that suffered solely from its lack of economic calculation. Thus, economic history as well as pure economic theory fails to establish that the economic calculation problem was a severe challenge for socialism." Now, you gave the example of the policy in communist Russia in the early days of Lenin, and then you mentioned the new economic policy from the beginning of the 20s. Mm-hmm. But you're right that those first few years, okay, we can't say that the only problem they were suffering was that they didn't have economic calculation. There were all kinds of other crazy problems. Mm-hmm. People were terrorized and whatever else. But that was a very clear case where they were trying to operate an economy ultimately without money at all. So they did come pretty darn close to an economy where there was no economic calculation. You had central planning without economic calculation. Because later on, in a lot of communist countries, what you actually had was just extreme intervention. But here you did have something closely resembling what Mises was critiquing, which was the economy in which production is being directed without the use of prices for the means of production, and the result was catastrophic. But maybe the result was catastrophic, though, Jeff, for potentially, you know, there could have been other competing reasons that it was catastrophic. The peasants were rising up against the regime or whatever. How can we say that the crushing reason, or that people didn't want to work because the pay was very low, and so they would shirk at work? How do we know that the shirking wasn't more important than the economic calculation, the lack of that? I think that's what he's saying here at the end. Is there any way that we can definitively reply to that?
Well, I'm not sure we could definitively do it by historical example. I think that's the whole point of having sound economic theory, is that these issues of the causal factors and their importance, theory gives us a guide toward what we would find as history, as a historical process works itself out, as to which causal factor is more important than another. And so that's why we have to be very careful to identify in the historical episode whether the conditions that are stipulated in the theoretical presentation are in fact present. Did the state in fact own all the means of production? Did they in fact eliminate money and so on? And if we see those conditions present or some approximation to them, then it's theory that leads us to the conclusion that the main reason behind the collapsing production was in fact this calculation problem. It occurs to me maybe another way that this could be done. I'm no historian, so I'm not sure about the actual history of this. But one could look at similar circumstances in other countries. That is to say, there were other countries at war at the same time. Presumably, some of them maintained a more market-oriented economy, and yet they were being, troops were coming and destroying their crops and their factories and so on. And maybe one could do a kind of comparative analysis to see which country fared better.
Jeff, let's pause for just a minute to thank our sponsor. Here's some good advice. Be an informed consumer and don't get scammed. There's been a surge in physical demand for gold, and the conditions are ripe for scammers. Oh, buy collectible coins. Buy coins with numismatic value. Get a leveraged gold account. Get this price protection plan. They're scams, and Peter Schiff's free report, Classic Gold Scams and How to Avoid Getting Ripped Off, will help you avoid them. Schiff Gold, which is where I get all my own precious metals, is doing the public a tremendous service with this report. See, the trouble is the precious metals industry is an extremely low margin one. So some dealers just can't resist the temptation to try to make it into a high margin one at your expense. That's why you won't want to make any moves with regard to gold without checking out Peter Schiff's free report, which you can read at tomwoods.com/scams. All right, let's move on to the monopoly theory section. All right, because Rothbard has a monopoly theory that's laid out in, I'd like to say Chapter 10 of Man, Economy, and State, but I don't know. It's one of the double-digit chapters. And he lays it out he makes a variety of arguments on behalf of his claim that there is no, and this is the way Kaplan summarized it, there is no independent criterion for identifying the competitive price as opposed to just the free market price. So that is to say, you can't render judgment on the market. You can't say, well, this monopoly is frustrating consumer sovereignty in some way, and it's imposing losses on society because it should be setting its price and quantity over here, but instead it's placing it over there. Rothbard is saying you have no independent place that's not arbitrary from which you can make a judgment like that. So it's Kaplan's claim that, first of all, that Rothbard seems to be, I think he's at least implying that Rothbard is making too ambitious of a claim. But then secondly, he's not. Well, let's start right there. Actually, why don't you elaborate a little bit on Rothbard's monopoly theory before we go into the weeds on Kaplan?
Okay, sure. So what Rothbard says is that in a completely abstract thought experiment, one might be able to make a stipulations where you get a comparison between one state of affairs and another, that you know, you just stipulate certain things and then you can make comparisons. But what he's pointing out is in the real world, that isn't possible. In the real world, all we have is the actual market outcome. And so if we were able to identify a monopoly in the market, we wouldn't be able to compare the price that existed in the market that monopoly was charging and the buyers were paying with any alternative competitive situation. We wouldn't know whether or not if we somehow took the real world and reconfigured that monopoly situation into a competitive one, whether the price would be higher or lower, whether the quantity would be larger or smaller. We simply don't know because we can't stipulate exactly what the conditions would be under which the competitive outcome would exist. To put it somewhat differently, there are dynamic adjustment processes in the market that might bring the monopoly about as an efficient result, that in fact it may be more efficient to have fewer firms in the market as opposed to more firms, because we can't see in the real world what the configuration of the competitive situation would be. So it might be that if we have more firms in the actual conditions of the real world, that their cost structure might be higher and the prices would actually be higher and outputs lower. It might be that the monopoly has some sort of, or the concentrated firm has some sort of a cost advantage. Or it could be that the monopoly has a advantage in the sense that it's the first mover into the market. And so the dynamic process of the market then would be that new entrants would come into the market over time, and the competitive process would work itself out to the most efficient solution. So Rothbard's basic point is that we can't really have in the real world any definitive comparative imaginary construct to say that the monopoly is either charging too high a price relative to this alternative, or that it's restricting output relative to that more competitive alternative.
All right, so now Kaplan will come back and say, you know, he says you need to address modern neoclassical theory head on, and he says Rothbard is dealing with Mises' theory of monopoly price, and he responds to that, but he says that, look, the neoclassicals will say that there is always some degree of monopolistic distortion unless firms face a horizontal demand curve. He says, so because unless they face a horizontal demand curve, the firm is going to set its price above its marginal cost. He gives this example. He says, you have a piece of software and the firm has to pay a dollar to produce every additional copy, but they'll set the profit maximizing price at $10. And therefore, there are unrealized gains to trade because consumers who've been willing to pay between $9.99 and $1 wind up not buying the program, even though it exceeds the marginal cost of production. So can't we say that there are all these unrealized exchanges that might have occurred, and they don't occur because of this monopoly power, and so therefore, things are somehow worse off?
Right. There are a couple of points here. The first is that it seems rather strange, and I'm not sure exactly how the Kaplan would think about this, but it seems rather odd that there can be unrealized gains to trade in every single market in the economy. I mean, how exactly is that possible? This seems to be the implication of what he's saying. Every demand curve slopes downward to the right, and so every market is underproduced, or there are these unrealized gains to trade. That doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem like that's even conceptually feasible. It would seem to be quite the opposite, that that in order to increase the trading in one market, we'd have to decrease it in another. But if every market has a dearth of trading simultaneously, again, it's hard to see conceptually how that can be so. But anyway, to get to the other point, the substantive point that he mentions, here I think it's a difference in approach that creates this seeming conflict between what Rothbard's saying and what Kaplan's saying. So the neoclassical approach to a price theory is to conceive of consumer demands for goods right now and production decisions by entrepreneurs right now as synchronous, so that somehow producers are deciding, making production decisions right now, and consumers are buying those goods instantaneously. That is, their demand is being expressed instantaneously, or if you will, synchronously for those goods. Whereas the Austrian view, Rothbard's view, is to take a realistic time frame and to say entrepreneurs must be making their production decisions in the past with respect to consumer demands. They made their production decisions a while ago, and now they're offering consumers the goods, and consumers are expressing their demands for those goods. So the decision to produce by the entrepreneur and the decision to sell the output by the entrepreneur are distinct in time. The production decision comes first. So if the production decision comes first, then the entrepreneur doesn't have actual consumer demands to consider. The entrepreneur only has his or her expectation of what consumer demands will be once the good is offered for sale in making his or her production decision. So that's the first thing to note. So once the production decision is made, when the entrepreneur offers the good to the consumer for sale, then production costs aren't relevant for deciding whether for the entrepreneur in deciding whether or not to sell the product to customers now at a particular price. The entrepreneur just has a couple of alternatives once the good's produced. That's either to sell it to the customers now who are offering a particular price, to hold on to the good and sell it in the future to other customers who might offer a better price, or to keep the good for private use, which is, again, unlikely in a division of labor. So once we separate out those two decisions, we see that they're separate, then Rothbard's analysis comes into play. So Rothbard simply says that the selling decision by the entrepreneur doesn't face costs, but faces only the consumer demand for the good. And therefore, the entrepreneur will always try to ask a price that maximizes revenue, irrespective of what his costs happen to be in the past. It isn't a profit calculation that's done synchronously. The profit calculation is done, as we said before, the comparison of input costs with anticipated output revenues is done by the entrepreneur when the entrepreneur makes production decisions.
He finishes up this section by saying that it's true that the theory of... We spent a whole episode, actually, not having to do with this article, but you and I did an episode on perfect competition, monopolistic competition, these concepts that you encounter in textbook economics. We showed all the difficulties with it because, according to this theory, basically monopoly is shot through the economy, absolutely everywhere. If there's even a brand name on an item, then that's kind of a quasi-monopoly. That monopoly is everywhere, and it just makes no analytic sense to think this way. And of course, the perfect competition model makes assumptions that are not helpful. They're supposed to be helpful, but they turn out to be bludgeons with which to beat the market economy, because the market economy doesn't live up to the expectations of perfect competition. Well, at the end of this, and I'll link to that episode because I don't want to go into that too great length here. I'll link to that at tomwoods.com/513. But here, Kaplan is saying that by and large, the neoclassicals have come to understand the problems with the theory of perfect competition. And now you have a lot of research from mainstream economists talking about the benefits of so-called imperfect competition outweighing its costs, the problems with the perfect competition model. And so he says, and some of them understand now that advertising is a good thing and not part of imperfect competition. So he says, in short, a powerful case now exists that free market structures are second best efficient. There is no feasible real world way to improve upon them. Unfortunately, while Rothbard gave the Austrians a head start, this has not prevented neoclassical research from passing them by. That, and I mention this because this is a theme that runs through the Kaplan article, that the Austrians had their insights here and there, but by and large, economists have really wised up and they've on their own figured out what nuggets of wisdom the Austrians have anyway, and they've done it through rigorous research, so there's no reason not to be one.
Well, you know, my reaction to this is simply to point out that even if we accept his conclusion that the neoclassical economists have sort of caught up to the Austrians in their own paradigm and sort of recognized the inadequacy of their previous attempts, the Austrians haven't been standing still in this area. And it's going to take a long time for the neoclassical economists to catch up with the research that has been inspired, for example, by Peter Klein on entrepreneurship. So the Austrians are not standing still. Our research project is developing, and it's a vibrant, and we're awaiting the neoclassical economists to catch up again.
Oh, that's the spirit. You know, the third, I think we may want to revisit this just so that we don't overwhelm people, because this is, you know, this is tricky stuff that we're talking about here. We might want to come back in another episode to the conversation about public goods. Now, you and I did an episode on public goods. I might be inclined just to link people to that. Although, you know, I still feel like we should probably hit the Kaplan criticisms, but he doesn't like Rothbard's rejection of neoclassical public goods theory. And I've already kept you kind of like the limit of the show. Not that we can't theoretically go on forever, but you know, people in the world are not my slaves. Not slaves to the show. So we'll come back to this soon. The public goods thing I'll want to hit on, but I also want to do. I did the business cycle section with Dave Howden, so I'll link to that on today's show notes page. But then we're going to get to some really juicy stuff, which is method. Of course, Austrian method is highly controversial these days anyway, and mathematics and econometrics, and what we can say about all these things and what Austrians say about all these things. That's where the rubber hits the road here, because this is where the fundamentals really and truly get addressed. So let's see if we can schedule a time in the very near future to finally sort of knock this out and then say, you know, that Jeff Herbner and I are now permitted to talk about other things.
That sounds good to me, Tom.
All right, very good. Let's make sure and do that. I really appreciate your time. I mean, we did, after all, hit pretty major topics here. The economic calculation problem itself could be the subject of three podcast episodes, and monopoly theory, you know, I don't think we have any reason to reproach ourselves. So thanks a lot, Jeff. I'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
All right, tomwoods.com/513 is where you want to go. I'll tell you about what's coming up on Monday. It's a juicy one. It's a juicy one on Monday. First, I'll remind you that, of course, Jeff is a faculty member over at mylibertyclassroom.com. Remember, this is not the same thing as the Ron Paul curriculum. That's for the youngsters. This is for you. And he teaches economics. He teaches a course in Austrian economics. He teaches a course where he goes through a major, major, major college economics textbook, and he goes through chapter by chapter, and he refutes it, or at least he shows what's wrong with it. It's not all wrong, obviously, but he shows what's wrong with it from an Austrian perspective. Very, very interesting. That course is also available to you, by the way, if you're a supporting listener of the show at the silver, gold, or platinum levels. You get that course as one of your benefits, so you can check that out over at supportinglisteners.com if you'd like to do that. Anyway, Monday, what's coming up? I forgot the coupon code. At libertyclassroom.com, if you want to join and you're a listener of the show, you can use coupon code SHOW in all caps for a special discount. I forgot the whole point was to tell you about the discount, and I almost didn't do it. On Monday, we're talking about Henry Kissinger. Now, there's a juicy topic right there, and we're talking about it with Greg Grandin. And what's interesting about that is he's got a new book out on Kissinger, but also he is more or less on the left. And I always find these episodes really, really interesting. I did one not too long ago, remember, with Diana Johnstone, who had written an article called, a book called Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. And she's on the left, too. We had a wonderful conversation. So I expect to have an equally wonderful one with Greg Grandin. I didn't point out to you at the time because I thought it would be awkward to do so on the same episode. But if you remember that Diana Johnstone episode, I don't remember the episode number offhand, she's 81 years old. And I didn't want to mention that because, as I say, I think it would be tacky to point that out, even with her not on the air. But isn't that something? I bet for not one second did you think to yourself, this must be an 81-year-old woman. Absolutely top-notch. And as a podcast host, you have to think about the caliber of the guest and is the guest going to be up for, you know, answering rapid-fire questions. And you have to ask, is she a Ron Paul 80 or 81 or, you know, or not? And boy, was she ever. Absolutely top-notch and fantastic. So now you know the secret of Diana Johnstone. She's 81 years old, and she is still as outstanding as ever. So tremendous. So tune in on Monday for Greg Grandin. Then I've got a tremendous episode also next week where I've got a husband and wife couple who are conscientious objectors. And that is going to be wonderful. There's no way that's going to be a bad episode. So if you haven't subscribed yet to the show, make sure you do so you don't miss these episodes. Remember, ContraKrugman.com is our new podcast. Bob Murphy and I release a new episode every week. That's just a weekly podcast refuting the Paul Krugman column. I'm violating all the rules of marketing on podcasts, by the way. I'm giving you too many calls to action. I should give you the show notes and just leave it at that, but I can't help it. ContraKrugman.com will probably be listed on the show notes, tomwoods.com/513, as a reminder anyway. All right, I hope you enjoyed today, and you'll definitely enjoy Monday, so don't miss that. See you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.